You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show, which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP.
The views expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management here at KTEP.
Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for The Weekend, and joining us today is a good friend of the station, former UTEP political science professor, Dr. Gregory Rocha. Greg, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you, Louis.
Now, you were the go-to guy a lot of times when you were still here on campus. We talked during elections. We talked about campaigns. We talked about primaries. We talked about caucuses, all that. And 218 has been quite a, gosh, for lack of a better word, I guess, incredible year as far as elections, midterms, and a lot of things going on in politics. And let's start, first of all, with the midterms. Tell us a little bit about your reaction as a political scientist.
Well, Louis, I thought it was fascinating to see what would happen this first set of elections with President Trump in office and all that had gone on during his first nearly 2 years in office. And generally, I think what we saw is that the Senate gained 2 seats for the Republicans, but the Democrats did quite well both in the Congress, in the House of Representatives, and then also at the state level. In fact, if you take a look at where the Democrats made major gains, it would really be along the Southwest and particularly along the border area. That is, we got a Democratic governor in New Mexico, for instance. We saw Beto O'Rourke almost win in Texas. And I talked to some friends of mine from around the state who were involved in campaigns, and they seemed to think that Beto's campaign really helped bring out Democrats, which led to the election of quite a few Democrats statewide. And so, for instance, there are now 12 new members of the Texas legislature. And again, many people attribute that to O'Rourke and his ability to enthuse Democrats in an election during which they normally don't vote. So I think it makes for a very interesting 2019, because this is the year that for everything gets set up for 2020. And as we know, Louis, time flies, whether in the electoral world or in our own world.
And you were mentioning before we even set up this interview, as you and I were having a conversation, and you mentioned because you're from Iowa and you have a lot of relatives in Iowa who were very curious asking you about Congressman O'Rourke.
That's true. And I was there during the summer months, and they were just fascinated with what he was doing and how he went about doing it. And now there's strong interest in him perhaps running for the presidency and going to Iowa to participate in the caucuses. A couple of weeks ago, the Des Moines Register published a poll to find out who are the top choices among the Democrats. And I think these are caucus attendees. And number one was Joe Biden. Number two, Bernie Sanders. Number three was Beto O'Rourke. So, again, there's just strong fascination with him, and we'll see what he can do in 2019.
Some people have said in the past that perhaps one of the things that hurt Secretary Clinton during the presidential election was Bernie Sanders. So do you think by Bernie Sanders throwing his hat in there again, it's going to hurt or help the party?
I think we'll have to see, Louis. I don't know how much is left of that coalition that he put together the last time to get through with the Democrats. And surely he tested Hillary Clinton. But now, my sense is there are so many people, so many Democrats, who believe that they can defeat President Trump in the 2020 elections, that there are just maybe about 15 or 20 challengers who are going to be in the run for the presidency. And if that's the case for Beto O'Rourke, well, he'll be one of many. And the challenge there is to distinguish himself from the rest and still show that the magic that, if I can call it that, that he had here in this state translates nationally. And then generally, Louis, he doesn't necessarily have to win, but he doesn't want to lose. He doesn't want to be near the rear end, because once that happens, with a large field like that, it gets winnowed down pretty quickly. And that's really the goal of the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primaries. Not so much to choose the winners, but to kind of get rid of the losers.
People have compared Congressman O'Rourke to Senator Obama when he just came out of nowhere and all of a sudden he was there. Because I think he was in the Senate for 18 months before he decided to run for president.
That's true. And it's not just, well, then Senator Obama. Bill Clinton in many ways came out of nowhere as the governor of Arkansas. And you could also say the same thing for Jimmy Carter, the governor of Georgia. And that's one of the more intriguing things about the Democrats generally, and particularly there in Iowa. If you can catch fire and enthuse people, then you've really got a pretty good chance. I was there 10 years ago to watch then-Senator Obama. And just going around and talking to people, you could hear all of this buzz about Obama. And this guy really looks to be the full package and so forth. And it was one of the states that helped him get the nomination. And that could be the same thing for O'Rourke.
Can you explain to us how Iowa and New Hampshire work?
Sure. The Iowa caucus is a meeting among people, really, a meeting among neighbors. And they go to, on a very cold day in Iowa, they're all cold around January and February, and they show their support for the candidate they prefer. So it's really like, again, a room full of people meeting to make a decision about who do we support, who finishes first, second, third, and fourth. And that's it very generally. And then in the New Hampshire primary, it's just like when we go to Election Day, where people cast a vote on an election machine, and they're in and out fairly quickly. To participate in the Iowa caucuses, you better be ready. It's going to take a few hours because it is a meeting. People have a chance to talk, and there's business to attend to. And I went the last time in 2016, and the one I went to for the Democrats lasted about 2.5 hours. The Republicans were done fairly quickly, but even that, Louis, that was an hour and a half. And so to get people out on a cold winter night to show support for a candidate is a daunting challenge. And one of the things that I noted happened, Louis, is that at least with the Republicans, the conservative religious groups have been pretty good at organizing and mobilizing their voters, and they have pretty strong control of what takes place in Iowa within the Republican Party. And so last time, it wasn't Donald Trump who won, but rather Ted Cruz, who ran as a fairly religious person, pretty conservative, and it served him well.
What about as far as we read in the newspaper, we watch television, listen to the radio, do something online, and we're seeing that both sides, Republicans and Democrats, have said that the parties have changed a lot?
Oh, there's no question about that, Louis. And we can see just on the issues and the way they're handled by both the Democrats and the Republicans. Now, perhaps more than ever, we can see that they're fairly polarized. And the Democrats have moved more to the left. Republicans have moved much more to the right. And it's very, very difficult for them to reach some kind of accommodation. We saw not long ago that both parties, again, at the national level, were able to work toward reform of the criminal justice system at the federal level. But that seems almost like an aberration, because when it comes to anything else, other policy matters, whether it's foreign policy or the environment or so forth, both the Democrats and the Republicans seem to be far apart from one another. And because they don't come into contact as much with one another as Democrats and Republicans did in Congress 30 or even 40 years ago, it's a lot harder for them to establish those personal ties, which really is the foundation of running any legislature or Congress.
As far as the election and the campaigning go, when you were teaching here at UTEP, your students a lot of times did exit polls, mm-hmm. And other polling. How has social media changed that as far as what you've seen? Because now we'll be watching television or read something online, and all of a sudden you say, the recent poll shows President Trump is favored in this area and not favored in this area, or if the election was held today, this is what they do. And some people may wonder, how do they go about getting those numbers, those opinions, and how are the mm-hmm. polls taken?
Well, I don't know if social media has, or I should say, I don't know what their effect is. But one of the outcomes, one of the things that's happened, and I think this has been an evolution, is that it's so much more difficult now to get people to speak and express their opinions to a polling organization, that they have to contact many, many more people before they can get the proper interview that they really need. not long ago, the New York Times tried to conduct a poll in one of the congressional districts in Iowa. And they couldn't do it because people didn't want to respond to the set of questions. Again, I think there's a lot of distrust that people have about polls, or they're concerned about expressing their opinions, or they just don't want to be bothered anymore. The luster and the allure of responding to these kinds of polls has diminished dramatically. And I noticed that even when we stopped, Louis, it was getting much more difficult for students to speak or to get people to respond. And they're students. People love students and they want to help them. But it was getting much more difficult for them to find people who were willing to participate.
And how did you go about setting up the questions? Like, for example, right now, I guess the big deal would be the wall, the government shutdown, Syria. So you pick whatever is in the news and address those to see how the people feel about it?
That, and we wrote the questions and we'd work it through. And again, this was really more an exercise for the students to learn how do you do these things? And the important thing was that they learned. So that, again, we were, how do you word a question about the border wall or foreign policy or anything like that? And work through that. We tested to see if respondents understood and weren't biased in any way, shape, or form, and then got it out there to see how people would respond.
One of the classes that you taught specifically dealt with the presidency, and some people have seen this administration as very different, very unique from other situations. And of course, now what's going on with the Mueller investigation, people are talking about Richard Nixon and what happened back in 1972, 74. But tell us a little bit about your experience in some of the previous administrations and what we see going on today.
Well, clearly, this is very much a change, as you see, what we have in Donald Trump, somebody who had no electoral experience beforehand. And just like we talked about before, Louis, when we said that the Democrats aren't the Democrats of old, the Republicans aren't the Republicans of old. Well, you know, how do you establish this kind of winning coalition to become president and then govern? We saw over the budget fight a couple of weeks ago that the president was concerned that his base of support didn't like the idea that he wouldn't support funding for a wall, for a border wall. And he's very much attuned to that. And surely other presidents have been that way. But it's, again, something quite a bit different, something unique to this president. And he found that he needed to take a stand on a particular issue, one that appeals to his particular segment of supporters. And that's really not all that different from presidents of the past. It's just, what are the issues and how do you, as a president, handle them? And as I said before, this is somebody who's never held an elected office before. And it's got to be just a daunting puzzle out there to try to figure out what do I do and how do I go about doing it. And we've seen the effect of that.
This is perhaps also probably one of the few presidents who had so many retired generals on his administration, his cabinet. But as we all know, recently General Mattis, his Secretary of Defense, said, I'm out of here at the end of February.
Right. And we've seen an extraordinary number of people who've exited, whether it's people in the realm of defense and foreign policy, people in the cabinet. It's the likes of which we've really never seen before. And normally we would see these retirements maybe after the first 2 years of an administration, simply because it's such a difficult, daunting position to hold, regardless. But the turnover in this administration is unlike anything we've seen before. And I think the big explanation that's been put forth as to why we see that is because of the way that the president handles those around him, where he's pretty rough with them. He doesn't necessarily listen to them. And that can cause quite a bit of consternation among those who are supporting him.
Some people might ask, Greg, well, What about Congress? Why don't they do something? Isn't there a checks and balances there? What is going on in Washington? And of course, we don't know. We haven't been there, but we also know what the Constitution says.
Well, I think what this has been during the first 2 years of the Trump administration, Republican Congress. And they, for the most part, have not been able to get much done, even though, again, the Republicans have full control of government. It's much like the Democrats before, where you learn that, sure, you have the majority, you control things, but just because you control things doesn't necessarily mean all is smooth. There are any number of fights that can take place within the group. We saw the Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives. We saw the Senate Democrats have been able to perform a block, shall we say, in the Senate. And Mr. Trump himself has been a pretty contentious person as well. So it's made for quite a bit of difficulty for the Republicans. And I assume in 2019, when the Democrats take control of the House of Representatives, we'll see little to nothing get done, even though everybody knows it's in their interest to do so. But again, those fights and those battles and those difficulties and the differences of the parties are going to make it very tough to get things through, to say nothing of an upcoming presidential election.
What do you see perhaps as the biggest challenge for Congress in 2019, excuse me.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be just to pass any legislation. Louis, again, they're so divided. And now we have the Democrats controlling the House of Representatives. How are they going to reach agreement on things? And even if they do reach agreement, how do they know the president's going to sign that piece of legislation? And so I think most people who keep an eye on the Congress tell you or assume that there's not going to be much done. And it's made all the more troubling because we have a presidential election coming up. And I don't think the Democrats want to give President Trump anything to crow about. And the president wants to make sure that if something happens, he's able to blame the Democratic House. And there's going to be a fair amount of fighting and not much done. So, like you've said, things have changed.
As you mentioned, new faces on the national level, state level, and local level. Let's talk, first of all, about 16th Congressional District here. Veronica Escobar, former county judge, is heading off to Washington. This will be her first time there. What can we expect from her and what can she expect to see?
Well, you know, one of the interesting and good things that I found out about Representative Escobar now is that she was an early supporter of Nancy Pelosi's speakership. And just from watching television and watching Ms. Pelosi speak before the public, and she's surrounded herself with a group of people who've come in. One of them has been our representative, Veronica Escobar, newly elected Latina from the Southwest. I think fits in well with the image she's trying to convey of this incoming Democratic group of representatives. So she'll have, I assume, pretty close ear of Speaker Pelosi. On the other hand, she just got there, and these chambers work in great part on the basis of seniority. So you have to get in there, do the work, put your nose to the grindstone, and really get after it and do something well. That said, I'm sure that she'll be given duties and assignments that relate to her congressional district, this region. So, it'll be up to her to figure out how to go about doing this and in which committees or what she does in the committee she's assigned to.
We're visiting with Professor Gregory Rocha, Dr. Gregory Rocha. We're talking about Politics 218 and perhaps some of the things that we can expect in 2019. Greg, we talked a little bit about New Mexico and Texas as well. Let's move to the Texas legislature and what are some of the things that we can expect the legislature to face this coming session.
I think it looks like to be the usual set of concerns. Now, again, as I mentioned, there are more Democrats in the House of Representatives, and that bodes well for them. But there have been any number of meetings, for instance, about school finance, and there's been quite a bit of discussion about public education and how to perhaps sort through and sort out all the difficulties that have arisen from the way that the state goes about funding education. And that looks to be one of the major concerns there. There are also issues of transportation and the petroleum industry and other aspects of the state's economy that the state has the legislature has an important part to play. And then, unfortunately for us, we're going to lose the voice and support of Joe Pickett, who was very, very well respected in Austin. That seat will be filled fairly soon, but his voice will be missing, and I'm sure everybody just wants to make sure that he gets well and gets the proper help to get him well again.
And he was on some pretty powerful committees.
Oh, absolutely. There was no question that when questions about transportation around the state came forth, he was the person with the most knowledge, whether it was in the House or the Senate. And one of the nice things about the legislature, Louis, unlike the Congress, which we just discussed, is that even though he was a Democrat, he was well-respected and became a pretty powerful leader in the House of Representatives on the matter of transportation. And so Republican governors would choose him often to serve as chairman of the powerful Transportation Committee, which reviewed legislation concerning transportation in the state. And we know this is an enormous state with quite a lot of important transportation issues before it. And Joe Pickett was right there in the center of it making decisions.
You mentioned also that we have a new governor in New Mexico. And what do you know about Governor Grisham Duhon, if anything?
Other than that she served in the House of Representatives, not much more than that. I think it's pretty intriguing to see that she took the seat from Governor Martinez, the Republican, and withstood the challenge from Representative Pierce, who I thought would do quite well in the state and probably hold it for the Republicans. That just didn't happen there. And it's much like the same in Arizona, where we got a new Democratic senator. So, again, as I mentioned when we started, in this region of the country, the Democrats did fairly well.
We have heard, whether it be television news, radio, newspaper, or online, the comparisons, as you mentioned earlier also, about perhaps what's going on right now with President Trump's administration and the Nixon administration. We also have heard about the relationships with Russia and Putin and, of course, what Reagan and Gorbachev did. And then, of course, we also heard about the meeting with Kim Jong and what's going to be expected in the future.
Yeah, and I think in the area of foreign policy, the president has put himself in a pretty difficult spot, especially with Republicans, who are pretty strong supporters of American influence globally. And when he made the move in Syria, you'll recall he got quite a bit of criticism from Republicans, and it's put him kind of out of sorts with what's going on. Up to now, Louis, If we take a look at polling, particularly among Republicans, we can see there's been pretty strong support for him in the steps that he's taken. Generally, I think it's somewhere in the 80% range of support within the Republican Party for him. And we haven't seen anything yet, but I'll be interested to see what Republicans think about taking those troops out of Syria. He ran on that issue. That, we are everywhere and we don't need to be everywhere. We need to start bringing troops home. Will that hold? And particularly in light of all that's been brought forth by people like Senator Lindsey Graham or Marco Rubio, You know, there's still that wing within the Republican Party of people who were pretty hawkish on defense policy.
And Senator Graham actually was very public about his criticism of President Trump's decision to remove those troops.
That's true. And even though he's done his best to try to ingratiate himself with Mr. Trump so that they could have a better working relationship. And there have been times when he's been supportive of the president and his policies and has gone to Mar-a-Lago and other places to kind of buddy up to him. But I guess to his credit, he still is willing to take the step to say that, you know, I disagree with you on this and I disagree with you strongly, as he did in Syria.
We haven't heard much about the relationship between President Trump and the new Mexican president.
That's true. I think President López Obrador has pretty much kept away from him in part. I believe one of the things he's trying to do is to get the United States, that is the Mexican president, is to get the Americans generally and get the support of President Trump to invest some money in Central America to start turning things around perhaps economically or institutionally there in those countries to reduce the need for people to leave the country. You know, the sizable numbers of people are leaving, as we know, and that has an effect not just on the U.S. but on the Mexicans, particularly in light of what's happened with the president's decision to reduce or to slow down the ability of people coming into the U.S. to stay once they've gained, you know, their initial petition effort. So there's quite a bit being done. We'll have to see if López Obrador will be able to do that.
And when he was elected, a lot of people decided to vote for him because they claimed or thought that he was very different from other candidates in the past. And the president has also mentioned that he's going to cut down some salaries and corruption and all that stuff that we've heard about Mexico for many years.
Yeah, and it looks like he's moving toward that with, as you said, the reduction in federal salaries, selling off those airplanes. That might be symbolic, but it's you know, a point to be made nonetheless. It's early in his administration, and I don't care whether it's the United States or Mexico or elsewhere. There is so much resistance to bringing about change that it's going to be a pretty daunting thing to do, but he seems to be ready to take those steps. And we'll see if he has to take the steps there that President Trump has made or done here to make his point.
Greg, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. We really enjoyed you. And again, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
We've been visiting with Dr. Gregory Rocha, political scientist, discussing a little bit going back about what happened in 2018 and what we can expect in 2019. Just a brief note that this interview was taped on December 21st, 2018. The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Sam Cassiano. Our producer is Vasil Zabinal. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Louis Sines.